Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Australian venoms. This is an article by Christy Wilcox in the Cosmos magazine. It's part of my cardiac rehab to read and be able to process this information. Now, of course, I like Australian venoms because they use some pretty unusual molecules, pretty nice molecules in actual fact. The article is Built to Kill, from the blue ringed octopus to cone snails. Nature's poisonous creatures have evolved clever ways to, I believe there's a word missing here, see off their prey. Painless, that's the word used by victims to describe the bite of a small octopus found in Australian tidal pools. I think this octopus actually is endemic from Japan to the Philippines, but it's most famous in Australia. There's a very different species, but let's go. Only about the size of a golf ball with patterned brownish and yellow skin, the species in the genus Hypocolochlina are all shy, preferring to avoid contact with humans or pretty much anything else larger than they are. They spend their days hiding using their colour-changing skin cells, chromatophores, to blend in with the environment, or tucking their gelatinous bodies into crevices and rocks of the reef. Though the species are modest in size and temperament, they are armed with some of the most potent venoms in the world. All of them are referred to by the same common name, which comes from the distinctive skin pattern they display when afraid: deep peacock blue circles, blue rings of death, as they have been called. A final warning to the blue ring, from the blue ring octopus: painless but deadly. Anthony and his twin brother didn't know it was dangerous. They were, after all, only 4 years old in 2006 when they discovered a small octopus in a rocky tide pool at the Sutton's Beach in Queensland, Australia. The boy's mother, Jane, said she saw Anthony playing with the little animal shortly before he complained that he had that it had bitten him. The young boy began vomiting almost immediately. His vision blurred and he quickly lost strength to stand. He said to me, "I can't walk," and his legs were all floppy, she reported. Luckily, he was quickly in the hands of emergency responders who knew exactly what was causing the sudden and severe symptoms. Though the bites aren't incredibly common, the blue-ringed octopus's reputation is now well known by first responders in the area where deadly cephalopods occur. They rushed him to hospital as he laboured to breathe. He soon lost control of his muscles altogether. He had to be transferred to a paediatric intensive care. Less than 30 minutes after the bite, the boy was dependent upon a ventilator for survival. It would be another 15 hours before Anthony's body managed to clear the toxin through enough toxin that he could begin to move his muscles on his own, and more than a day before he was strong enough to be discharged. If he had been any further from medical care or could not describe his assailant, Anthony likely would have been not survived. A similar creature killed a full-grown man just over half a century earlier, before the first responders knew the blue ring octopus were armed with such potent venoms. Oh, this is interesting. Kirk Dyson Holland, or Dutchy as he's known to his friend, was 21 in 1954 when he went spearfishing with his friend John about 5 kilometres from Darwin in Australia. They were strolling along the tidal pools of the beach when they spotted a little reef octopus. Believing it to be good bait and future fishing efforts, John picked up the animal and let it crawl over his arms and shoulders. He and Dutchie had played with octopuses before and never had cause to concern. John soon handed the small creature to Dutchie, who let it wander over him as he walked until it made its way to his neck. Dutchie didn't feel the bite, but a few minutes later his mouth went dry. As he walked away from the water's edge, he started vomiting, struggling to breathe. He fell to the sand. John got him off the beach and to hospital. One of the last things Dutchie said to his friend before losing his ability to speak: "It was a little octopus. It was a little octopus." He died 2 hours later. Okay, that's different from the story I had about an American sailor who in Darwin around the same year. So that's interesting. But we're different. At time, Dutchie's death was presumed to be from an allergy to octopus saliva, an unfortunate medical complication. Even a decade later, when Bruce Halstead compiled and wrote one of the most cited tomes on toxic animals ever published, Poisonous and Venomous Marine Animals of the World, little was known about the venom of octopus and their relatives. The life-threatening bites and deaths were considered aberrations. But in 1970, the Australian scientists Shirley Freeman and J.R. Turner isolated the most lethal component of the venom of one such little octopus, the Hypalochina mollusca, calling it macular toxin in the absence of knowledge about its chemical composition. When injected into rats and rabbits, the compound caused steep drops in the blood pressure and the heart rate and could completely paralyze the animal's respiratory system. Years later, scientists confirmed that the macular toxin was in fact the same compound found in fresh pufferfish, the infamous tetrodioxin. I love that molecule. I will do a podcast on it. Tetrodioxin is among the most deadly compound known to man. It's more potent than arsenic, cyanide, and even anthrax. It's 120,000 times as deadly as cocaine, 40,000 times as deadly as methamphetamine. It's the world's most lethal. It's one of the world like the most of the world's lethal compounds. It's a neurotoxin. It targets our body nervous system. Unlike the hemotoxins of rattlesnakes and spiders, neurotoxins are fast-acting killers. They numb and incapacitate the inhibiting communication between cells. The cells in our bodies have several ways of communicating, but the fastest through electrical signals. Electricity isn't just the wires and batteries. It is, by definition, the energy that results from the existence of charged particles. And any time you have a barrier where there's more charge on one side than the other, there's a potential for movement should the barrier break down. That's literally what the voltage measurement, the potential energy is caused by differences in charge. Your cells are essentially microbatteries with cell membrane acting as a barrier between two different charged solutions. Your average cell is a resting potential of minus 70 millivolts. Wow. Which simply means that there's a slightly more negative charges inside than outside the cell. Cell membranes maintain the potential constantly, using energy to actively pump out sodium ions that sneak in and pump in potassium ions that leak out. Importantly, the nervous system causes the membrane potentials to send lightning-fast signals to and from different parts of the body along long, skinny cells called neurons. Well, that's interesting. To type this paragraph, my brain has to send signals to the muscles of my fingers to tell them when to move. When my skin cells touch the keyboard, the pressure causes mechanoreceptors just beneath my skin, the outermost layer of the epidermis, to activate, opening up force-sensitive ion channels, allowing the sudden influx of sodium into the cell. For a brief moment, there's more positive charge inside than out, and the potential of the small section of the membrane around the channel has opened up. When I touch the key, it becomes plus 30 millivolts when the force-gated channel shuts. Nearby on the membrane are similar ion channels that respond to changes in voltage rather than force. So when the sodium ions flood into the cell, they swing open. Some of these are potassium channels that serve to return the membrane to the way it was. Positive outside, negative inside, by letting potassium rush out of the cell. When the membrane is back to the way it should be, these shut and active pumps on the membrane slowly return the sodium potassium into the side of the membrane where they belong. All along the membrane, there are voltage-gated channels, so once triggered, the movement of the ion sets off the next closest. That's interesting. Okay, the voltage-gated sodium channel swings open. The whole process is repeated just a tiny bit further down. The domino cascade, like, is how electrical signals move from one end of a long neuron cell to another, eventually telling my brain my finger felt something. The ions travel very fast speeds across very small distances. The opening and closing of ion channels happens very, very quickly. The channels are where the neurotoxins attack. Gee, I don't know whether this is all correct. I've got to really remember this. Okay. Tetrodioxin, for example, is a sodium channel blocker. When the blue ring octopus bites, the tetrodioxin in the venom shuts down the victim's neuronal signaling, leading to numbness radiating from where it entered the body. Nausea, vomited, diarrhea follow. Weakness and paralysis are far behind. The brain simply cannot tell the muscles to move. Even breathing requires electrical signals. Tetrodioxin slows and eventually stops the diaphragm altogether. At high enough doses, the victim's heart is unable to beat. But tetrodioxin isn't a universal toxin. That's because not all sodium channels are the same. Even with our own bodies, there are many variations on the same general theme. Tetrodotoxin can be deadly because it strongly bonds to a range of sodium channels that are found crucially throughout our bodies and those of other vertebrates. But there are other variants to sodium channels that it isn't effective against. The blue-ringed octopus are wholly unaffected by their own venom component. That's not because... And they're not the only species. Tetrodotoxin is wielded either as a weapon of defense by salamanders, frogs, crabs, sea stars, and even snakes in addition to pufferfish, or is it either resistant or immune to its effects. Just how many channel types are there? A lot more than you think. Potassium channels, for example, are made of a combination of four protein parts. We have 70 or so different genes for these parts. So if you make a channel using four exact copies from one gene, we'd have 70 different potassium channels. But it turns out the combinations work too. You can have three of one and one of another, or all four pieces completely different. Theoretically, there's upward of 24 million different combinations that scientists have yet to determine if all of them exist, what they do. What we don't know is how bodies employ a plethora of them, each with a different purpose. Some are found only in the brain neurons, while others dominate motor neurons that talk to muscles. Channels for other ions are similarly diverse. Venom from diverse species contain neurotoxins that affect every step of our neuronal signals. Some, like tetrodotoxin, shut down critical channels, while others pry them open. Some stop signals at the very beginning or ends of these pathways. Some indiscriminately act on a broad range of given channel type, while others are incredibly specific. Tetrodotoxin is an example of the former, a brute of a neurotoxin which is lethal to most animal species because it acts on many different types of sodium channels. On the other end of the spectrum are toxins employed by another group of marine mollusks, compounds known for their elegance, for each has a very specific molecular target. Like arsenal mixologists, these snails craft intricate, unique venom cocktails that precisely incapacitate their prey. And when it comes to paralysis, no group compares with the impressive cone snails. The mollusks pack potent venoms, one that still remains a rich source of new toxin sequences for scientists such as Balomo Oliveira, even though he's studied them for almost 50 years. I had not really intended initially to work on this for very long, he explains with me as we walk through the extensive macrology mollusk science collection at the Bishop's Museum in Honolulu. Cool, somewhat dark hallways are lined with floor-to-ceilings with grey metal cabinets full of shells. Balomo, or Toto as he is known by his friends and colleagues, is one of the world's leading experts on cone snails. He first began studying their deadly venoms in the late 1960s. As a neuroscientist, he was intrigued by the species with toxins that attacks neurons, and the cone snails were an obvious choice. Because I collected shells as a kid, I knew these snails were capable of killing people. Cone snail venoms cause near instantaneous paralysis of their prey. They don't normally strike at humans. You have to do something fairly stupid to get stung, Toto says. But more than a dozen deaths have been caused by the venoms, most of which are attributed to one species in particular, the geographer's cone, Conus geographus, the first stone snail Toto ever studied. Initially set out to discover what made the geographer's cone so deadly, and began by injecting the venom into the abdomen of rice. The furry test subjects were then placed upside down, clinging to a wire mesh. As the venom spread through their little bodies, it caused sweeping paralysis and eventually the animals would fall. That was an experimental test Toto used to isolate the paralytic compounds falling mice. He carefully separated the venom components through various sizes of chemical filters, slowly pinpointing exactly what parts of the venom were responsible for the paralytic activity. He was able to narrow it down to peptides, small proteins less than 20 amino acids long, which have become known as conotoxins. After several years' research, he discovered two potent conotoxins. One acts like, much like pterodotoxin, shutting down the sodium channels, and the other one is similar to the venom found in cobras. My godfather. He'd solved his quest and had enough funding to afford better equipment. it was time to move on, but his cone cell research on the back burner tended by students. But then a 19-year-old student named Craig Clark changed everything. Craig had an out-of-the-box idea. Instead of just injecting the venom components into a mouse's body, he thought he should inject them into the mouse's central nervous system. Craig went on to do what he proposed and made a startling discovery. Many of the venom components overlooked in the falling test that affects in mice, when injected into their brains, and the effect was weird. Some peptides caused the mice to jump and twist. Others made them run in circles, even put them to sleep, but only if they were less than 3 weeks old. In adult male mice run from corner to the corner of the enclosure to the other. While new fancy equipment, including HPLC, that allowed fine-scale separation of each peptide, Toto and Craig discovered an unexpected diversity of conotoxins. Suddenly realized the venom was not only a few paralytic toxins, but it was an incredibly complex, diverse pharmacological mix. That experiment changed everything. After Craig's incredible insight, Toto went on to host a troop of undergrads. Each could choose any cone style they wanted, and then they would use Craig's test to purify the conotoxin that caused the activity of their choice. One undergrad in the early 1980s decided to purify a compound called shaker peptide because the mice that received it would have characteristic tremors. His name was J. Michael McIntosh, studying the magic cone, Conus Magnus, a peptide discovered who's called the Omega Conotoxin MVIIA. Nowadays, though, it's known by a different name, Prelate, the first FDA-approved drug from cone snail venom. But this is still only scratching the surface of the cone snail's venom diversity. The toxins shut down motor neurons are what Toto refers to as motor cabral, because cabrals are the secret society's cabals that overthrow existing authority, he explains. Every toxin in the motor cabal is able to paralyze a fish, but because they all work by shutting down the neurons directly, they are slow acting. It takes about 20 seconds for a motor cabal conotoxins to move via the circulatory system around the fish's body and reach enough neurons to stop the snail meal from wriggling away. That's just fast enough for a snail to reach and catch a fish. We know they have fast-acting toxins. Video fish hunting cone snails show that when they strike, their meal is frozen in the blink of an eye. A completely different set of toxins cause the initial paralysis, what Toto calls a lightning strike cabal. Instead of turning off channels, this cabal, dominated by delta and kappa classes of conotoxins, fling them wide open and keep them that way. The result is a flood of action potentials radiating from the sting site. As the fish is getting electrocuted, muscles throughout the body receive a signal to clench over and over. The fish becomes instantly rigid throughout. The lightning strike, the motor cabal combo, is just the one of the ways fish hunting snails catch their meals. Other snails have different hunting strategies, such as putting the whole school of fish into an insulin coma and relying on other cabals to precisely manipulate their prey. And recently, scientists discovered that cone snails just don't make toxins. They make different set of toxins to defend themselves with, which are able to wield when distinct predatory and defensive venoms as circumstances require. Suddenly it makes sense why each cone snail species has so many conotoxins. But how did they come to have such diversity? No two cone snail species possess the same peptides. Each has its own unique set. There are more than 500 species in the genus Conus, more species than any other genus in the ocean. And the cone snails are just the beginning. Toto estimates that if you look at the extended family tree of cone snails, there are more than 10,000 venom marine snail species on the planet, each with anywhere from a few hundred to several thousand different toxins, most of them including the incredible biodiversity turrid snails, have never been examined in the laboratory because they are smaller than an inch long and live in areas that are less accessible and habitats of shallow water-loving cones. But they too are chock-full of venom peptides. But that count, there may be anywhere from 300,000 to 30 million different toxic peptides just waiting to be discovered and sequenced. That kind of venomous success is unmatched by any other toxic group. So how does the venomous snail create so many toxins? The secret is their genetic advantage. Their venom genes are among the fastest evolving DNA sequence on Earth. We tend to think of evolution by its outward effects, the diversity of traits and behaviours that set the species apart from its closest relatives. But evolution is a measure of genetic change, not physical differentiation. After all, individuals in a species look very different from one another, but can remain tethered by a genetic makeup. For a century, scientists have defined evolution as a change in frequency of genetic variations, called alleles, in a population. The rate or speed of evolution then refers to how fast the alleles mutate and duplicate. When it comes to evolutionary speed, the venomous snail are at the Usain Bolts of the animal kingdom. You thought snails were slow. Conotoxin's genes are among the fastest duplicating genes on Earth. The A superfamily conotoxin genes, for example, spontaneously clone themselves on average 1.13 times every million years. That's three times as fast as the fastest duplicating gene in the whole genome studies of other animals. And it's at least as twice as fast as the gene it's renowned for the evolutionary speed, such as the genes that encode our ability to smell. And when scientists looked at just more the most recent 2 million years of cone snail evolution, the rate of duplication is even faster. A superfamily conotoxin genes, of which each species possess dozens, were duplicating at a rate of more than 4 copies per million years. More importantly, cone snails maintain this high duplication rate, never settling in. No other animal species is known to have such constantly duplicating genes. Okay. The genes don't just duplicate, that is, make a separate copy of them. They also change exceedingly fast. The rate of non-synonymous substitution of canotoxins is estimated at 1.7 and 4.8% per million years. That's five times as many mutations as the highest rates reported for mammals, and three times faster than the highest rate found in fruit flies. And that's just an average rate. Right after duplication event, non-synonymous substitution rate is at least 23% per million years. So whatever the synonymous duplication rate means, I don't know. And while cone snails set their bar for speed, many venomous animals have toxin genes that clock in with high evolutionary rates, particularly their neurotoxins. Rapid diversification is a hallmark of many venoms. That accelerated molecular evolution leads to an inconceivable toxin diversity. More toxins than scientists have been able to count, sequence or study, and yet venoms from species as disparate as octopus and snakes converge upon the same target. The actual molecules in venom are hypervariable, but the functions of those components seem remarkably conserved. The drive for evolutionary speed isn't to come up with new targets to attack, it's to ensure that toxins stay potent over time. Neurotoxins, as you can see in the case of cone snails, are excellent for capturing prey and causing rapid paralysis and a great way to slow down your potential meal. But the minute venomous predators start using molecules to shut down the prey's sodium channels, it creates a strong selective pressure in the prey for the sodium channels that don't respond to these toxins. Sometimes all it takes is a few mutations to derail a toxin's activity. Venomous animals must always be prepared to change things up. Throw a curveball and hope they get a strike. Or, as the cone snails do, to throw hundreds of balls at once, making damn sure their prey can't hit them all. What the snails are doing is the equivalent of a combination of combination drug therapy, Toto explained. They don't just use one drug for physiological endpoint. They use multiple components. Beautiful article. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.